Coming up, 2017, the examined year.
What happened this past year to challenge our assumptions and make us think about things in new ways?
The ways that women have been subject to grabbing and groping and, you know, this sort of premise of constant availability.
The Year in Gender Relations with Laura Kipnis from Northwestern University.
There's a sort of feudal relation that these bosses and harassers have had to women where they treat them as vassals.
Two things have happened over the course of the 20th century.
The year in democracy and social media.
We democratized enormously more. The power of elites diminished significantly.
Larry Kramer, president of the Hewlett Foundation.
And then with the advent of social media and the internet, suddenly that public is now getting exposed to massive amounts of bad information.
Join us as we shed philosophical light on the ideas and events of the past 12 months.
It's the examined year, 2017.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm Josh Landy. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where I teach philosophy and Josh directs the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today, it's a special edition of Philosophy Talk. It's the examined year 2017. We're taking a look back at the philosophical significance of events and ideas that have shaped the last 12 months.
Because the unexamined year is simply not worth reviewing.
Later in the show, we'll be joined by some special guests to think about the year in gender relations and the year in democracy and social media.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Liza Veal, takes us on an audio tour of 2017. She files this report.
I love this country, and because I love this country, I am horrified by its blemishes. And this immigrant ban is a blemish, and it is un-American.
We are united in that we are all human beings, and we are all together on this horrible, painful, joyous, exciting, and mysterious ride that is being alive.
Don't be so overly dramatic about it, Chuck. You're saying it's a falsehood, and they're giving Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts to that. But the point remains.
Alternative facts? Look, alternative facts are not facts. They're falsehoods.
You've got Russia. If the president puts Russian salad dressing on his salad tonight, somehow that's a Russian connection.
Sean! Come on, Sean! Sean!
My body, my choice!
My body, her choice!
My body, my choice!
This is an outpouring of energy and true democracy like I have never seen in my very long life.
I'm sorry. No. There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
Moonlight won.
This is not a joke. Moonlight has won Best Picture.
Iraq's prime minister celebrating on Saturday, saying Iraqi forces had driven the last remnants of Islamic State out of the country, 3 years after they captured around a third of Iraq's territory.
And we can't have madmen out there shooting rockets all over the place. Rocket Man should have been handled a long time ago. Little Rocket Man.
The first 9 months of 2017 were also the second hottest in nearly a century and a half.
The United States will cease
scientific agencies
all implementation
also highlighted some unusual
of the non-binding Paris Accord.
It was Hurricane Irma, the strongest hurricane to hit Florida since 2005, and Hurricane Maria, the most powerful storm to hit Puerto Rico since 1928.
Because wherever we live, whoever we are, we all share the same responsibility. Make our planet great again.
To my Republican colleagues, please don't lecture us on health care. You have no credibility on the issue of health care.
Jews will not replace us! Jews will not replace white men!
Of course we're capable. I'm carrying a pistol. I go to the gym all the time. I'm trying to make myself more capable of violence.
Jeremy Corbyn!
Rise like lions after slumber in unvanquishable number. Shake your chains to earth like dew. Ye are many, they are few.
Woo!
We are here. We are in totality. Yes. Yes. Oh, absolutely beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. We have totality is complete. Wonderful. Wonderful.
Realize when the vote is this close that it's not over. But we also know that God is always in control. You know, part of the thing, part of the problem with this campaign is we've been painted in an unfavorable and unfaithful light that it's not over.
Please, I'm not going to do anything. I swear, my children, please come in. On everything. I'm a famous guy.
I'm feeling very uncomfortable right
please
now.
Please come in now. Oh, please, I'm sorry. Just come on. I'm used to that.
Are you used to that?
Yes, come in.
I don't have a tidy soundbite for you because I've learned that when I've spoken in anger, I usually regret the way I express myself. So I've been waiting to feel less angry. And when I'm ready, I'll say what I have to say.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Liza Veal.
Some of the voices and sounds of 2017. Thanks, Liza, for that report. I'm Ken Taylor, here with my Stanford colleague Josh Landy, and we're taking a philosophical look at the last 12 months. It's the examined year, 2017.
As we heard at the end of Liza's audio tour, there's been a good deal of justified anger expressed over the past year. The Women's March in Washington, the Me Too movement, protests against Roy Moore, Uma Thurman, many other people coming out and speaking out against injustice. This is a movement that's here to stay. It's got the power to reshape the boardroom, the newsroom, even our politics. So let's talk about the year in gender relations.
We're joined now by Laura Kipnis. She's a professor in the School of Communications at Northwestern University, and author this past year of Unwanted Advances, Sexual Paranoia Comes to Campus. Laura, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thrilled to be here.
So, Laura, this has been a pretty dramatic year in terms of gender, both for good and ill. There have been major political victories for female candidates in special elections. A transgender woman got elected to office, defeating the sponsor of Virginia's bathroom bill. But at the same time, we've got a grabber-in-chief in the Oval Office who's attempting to cut funding for women's services and to ban transgender individuals from the military. So are these the best of times or the worst of times?
Well, I actually feel quite excited about the recent events, the Me Too, and the exposure of these incredible serial harassers that we've seen and women coming forward and talking about their experiences. And in the New York Review of Books piece that I just wrote about it, which was a review of Gretchen Carlson's book about sexual harassment in the workplace, I think I call it a revolution or a cultural revolution or the overthrow of this sort of pseudo or neo-aristocratic class that needs to be liquidated before women can have full equality. So I am excited about this moment. So I'm going to say best of times.
Well, does that mean there's nothing for you to write more for you to write about? I mean, you're deeply intrigued, I think I would say is the word, by both male and female sexual agency. And you say some very provocative things about both. So are all the problems solved? And when you say the best of times, are there struggles over to have a healthier form, a more self-affirming form of both female and male sexual agency? Or are we still in troubled waters where those two things collide?
Oh, no, I think it's an ongoing struggle. What I think is good about this moment is more transparency about a lot of the stuff that goes on behind the scenes. And I also think, you know, in terms of the harassers in Congress or in the media or in all sorts of spheres of culture, that it's a kind of, you know, to use an overworked phrase, wake-up call to men and particularly for a certain kind of male obliviousness. I mean, I think what's interesting and what I do think is positive is this way that certain taken-for-granted kinds of behaviors are no longer going to be taken for granted. And especially this issue, which I wrote about in the New York Review, about women's bodies as public property. And I think that it's time for that to end. And even some of these kind of exposés about things that are regarded as mild, like Al Franken grabbing women's butts, you know, while taking a photograph. I think I at one point would have said, okay, what's the big deal? But I think as we start seeing the extent of the ways that women have been subject to grabbing and groping and, you know, this sort of premise of constant availability, I do think that this is a problem that has to be addressed and men have to address it.
So I guess one question that's been coming up a lot in recent weeks is the question of whether it's still appropriate to watch, for example, a film with Kevin Spacey, whether it would have been appropriate for him to continue in his TV series, it's appropriate for us to watch previous episodes of that series. You know, I'm a big fan of The Usual Suspects. I wrote a paper about it. I don't know whether it's appropriate now for me to teach it. What's your view on all this stuff? Is it okay for us to continue appreciating art that's made by morally troubling individuals or made with the participation of morally troubling individuals?
Yes. I mean, I think there are two different issues. This idea that, you know, they're going to like scrub him out of the films like it's some kind of Soviet era,
right.
You know, yeah. Airbrush people out of or whatever they did technologically out of the photos, you know, because where do you draw the line? I mean, are you going to scrub all of Hitchcock's work? I mean, I think Polanski's made some amazing films. So I think that's a different thing than if somebody has a track record as a known harasser, allowing them to continue to work.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, where you're putting people in uncomfortable positions in the current moment. So I think partly what happens in these situations is all distinctions get collapsed. And there really is this immense overreaction. And that's what I think, you know, this idea of scrubbing people out of, you know, films, digitally scrubbing them is, I think, scary and stupid.
So let's think a bit about the distinctions we'd want to keep. I mean, I think that's a really important point, that distinctions are being collapsed. So one distinction you're pointing to is between somebody making money and continuing to be able to harass versus not. What are some other distinctions you think are important in this domain?
Well, I did make the distinction in the New York Review article, which was something I started thinking about in the harassment situation between force and power. And I started thinking about it with some of the reports of women about their encounters with Harvey Weinstein, and that in some cases he did use physical force to overpower women and, you know, have his way with them. But in other situations, it was intimidation and his sort of coasting on the aura of power. And some women succumbed to that and allowed themselves to be manipulated by him. And other women stood up to him, including like turning the tables on him. The actress who wrote a piece in the Times magazine about, you know, taking control of the situation and just not putting up with the stuff he was demanding of her. So if you understand, as I think she did in that moment, that he didn't have power over her. He might have had power over her career. So she was able to make that distinction, and it gave her options in that moment. So the force-power distinction, I think, is one. There's another distinction, and I started thinking about this with Al Franken, because some people were saying, well, this was a minor thing. And I thought about the distinction not between small and large offenses, but the degree of aggression in the offenses, you know, versus the degree of sort of bumblingness, which I think in some of the situations was people just saying dumb things in dumb ways. And I think that Franken actually was quite aggressive in those situations, if those accusations are true, you know, that he was grabbing women's butts while, you know, taking photos. I mean, that is aggressive when you're touching people, you know, in places and ways they don't want to be touched.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. It's the examined year, 2017. We're talking to Laura Kipnis of Northwestern University about the year in gender relations.
In some ways, men and women aren't made for each other. That is to say, suppose that men as a collectivity could just say, this is what we want female sexuality and agency to be like. I don't think women would like the picture if their agency was totally determined by the wishes and desires of men. Suppose women could say to men, this is what we want your agency to be like. And I don't think men would, they wouldn't find that acceptable as a collectivity. So you put these two groups of people together, and the species, in order to continue, has to have them together. And they've got this ongoing, intense push and pull of whose agency and whose form of agency will be dominant and celebrated. And social and humans are really bad at making perfect social institutions. They're never perfect, right? They're always problematic. That's why they always evolve. They collapse and get rebuilt. And so human life is just a mess. That's what I think.
You know, in the past, I've written about pornography. I wrote a book called Bound and Gag, Pornography and the Fantasy of the Politics of Fantasy in America. And part of what I was saying was that I think pornography, that's its function, is it's this male fantasy in the heterosexual context, I mean, of this endless available sex from women and women who want to do all the same things men want to do at the, you know, at the same time and the way they want to do it. And, you know, it's often been said that romance fiction is pornography for women, and that's women's fantasy of how male sexuality should look.
Right.
So, I mean, I think that there is a way that I, too, am sort of dire or pessimistic about heterosexuality, and there is a mismatch. I'm going to go along with you on that. Yet, for the majority of people, that's a sexual, you know, form of sexual expression or sexual identity that we're stuck with. So I think all these things are being renegotiated at the moment. Maybe they are constantly being negotiated, but I do think heterosexuality is the culprit. Yes.
Yeah, I think the renegotiation, that's the lot of human beings. If we're going to find a way to thrive together, it's a matter of constant negotiation and renegotiation and no being led to archaic traditions that were somebody else's settled point in cultural history. And this is a really hard thing.
I think that's true in that, you know, you have these kinds of, you know, in political economy terms, they talk about uneven development, you know, where you have older economic forms persisting. And, you know, that was the argument I was making, that there's a sort of feudal relation that these bosses and harassers have had to women where they treat them as vassals. So you have this kind of unevenly developed archaic form coexisting with these modern and postmodern forms. And I think that that's something to pay attention to, the remnants of all these vestigial kinds of behaviors coexisting, you know, with like a kind of more modern, and I am a kind of pro-development, pro-modernity sort of feminist, because I do think modernity has solved or at least, you know, addresses a lot of the problems that where there was this far more kind of gender imbalance in tradition and still is in traditional cultures.
Yeah, I'm with you. So, Laura, this has been great conversation, and I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
2017. Mm-hmm. Women.
Laura Kepnes from Northwestern University on the year in gender relations. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're looking through a philosophical lens at the ideas and events that shaped the last 12 months. It's the examined year, 2017.
If you got most of your news from Facebook and Twitter this year, chances are you may have been exposed to Russian propaganda. Has social media made our civil life more democratic? Or has it put our institutions into mortal danger?
It's the year in social media and democracy when Philosophy Talk continues.
What a year!
Welcome back to Philosophy Talk. It's the examined year, 2017. I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm Josh Landy. We're taking a philosophical look at some of the ideas and events of the past year that challenged our assumptions and made us think about things in new ways.
Up next, it's the year in democracy and social media.
Two-thirds of adults in America said they get some of their news from social media.
Facebook says about 10 million people saw Russia-linked ads on its sites before and after the 2016 election.
Well, Google and Facebook are apologizing for amplifying false news stories that surfaced in the hours after the shooting.
On Twitter, you had these bots, these automated accounts that were helping to spread fake news.
Are President Trump's tweets considered official White House statements?
Well, the president is the president of the United States, so they're considered official statements by the president of the United States.
It's not policy. It's not an executive order. It's social media.
The president tweeted on Friday, after I got fired, that I better hope there's not tapes.
Donald Trump is basically running the entire country with his thumbs.
We're joined now by Larry Kramer. He's president of the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation and former dean of the Stanford Law School. Larry, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So, Larry, you know, a lot of people think that the internet and social media is a great thing because they democratize the dissemination and consumption and access to information. That's a great thing, it sounds like. Other people say, no, these things are actually undermining democracy. Can both those things possibly be true, that they're the great democratizing thing, but at the same time, they're undermining democracy somehow?
So, yes, right? So on the one hand, you know, the access to information is unquestionably great. It annoys my wife because I, you know, in every conversation, immediately check every fact. But, you know, having that access is unbelievable for people. On the other hand, you know, there is too much of a good thing. And when it comes to democracy, I think it depends, always has depended on a degree of paternalism built in.
Democracy, wait a minute. Democracy is very opposite of paternalism, isn't it?
Not if it's going to last. Not if it's going to work, right? That was the key insight in the founding generation. It's why we're a republic and not a direct democracy.
But we're talking about, you know, we started this conversation about information. Aren't we also talking about misinformation? I mean, there's that, you know, the famous Jefferson line that when a people is well-informed, yeah, it can be trusted with its own government. We're living in an age when people are not well-informed.
Well, so they're probably neither better nor worse informed than they've been at past times. They're differently informed, certainly. But, you know, there's always been enormous amounts of accurate and inaccurate and fuzzy in the middle kinds of information. The question is what people make of it, how they use it, and how political branches and a government actually responds to that. So, you know, the way I like to think about this, you can have a reasonably well-informed public and maybe run a democratic system that way, or you can have a public that defers to an elite that is reasonably well-informed, and that's actually the way democracies have always worked. And right now we're kind of in a position where we have neither.
But democracy has to be able to have a way for the people to hold the elite to task.
Yes, yes, which they do, right? Which is like, we'll come back to the information problem because that is a big part of it. But what you're doing in constructing a Republican government is balancing independence and accountability. So all of the branches, all of them, including even the Supreme Court, are accountable, but they have different degrees of independence that gives them the room to act responsibly, inform, and educate so that they can bring the public around to ideas.
But, so the democratization of information access and its dissemination, it's not just my access to, but if I want to disseminate information to the world, if I want to disseminate my point of view to the world, right now all I have to do is put up a website and think of cool ways to drive, effective ways to drive traffic to it, and boom, I'm on a par with this is a dream, but I could be on the par with the New York Times or the Washington Post or CBS News, right?
And that is the problem, right?
Now, tell me why that's a problem rather than...
Okay, so this
why
is...
Why that's a bug rather than
this
a
is
feature.
A longer explanation. So if you think about free speech or the right to free speech, the scope of that is always, there's an explicit cost-benefit analysis, something we're aware of. That's what we argue about. But there's always an implicit one, which is invisible to us because it comes from the world in which we're given. So all of our ideas around public access to information, how the public uses information, were actually built into a world in which the technology made it so everybody couldn't be the New York Times. And the result of that was those organizations that actually could reach the mass public and reach masses of people exercised a kind of responsible curation. I mean, they did. So they might lean a little left. They might lean a little right. Most people on the right thought they all leaned a little left. But wherever they were leaning, they were actually working pretty hard, at least in the modern political era, to be responsible mainstream informers of the public. And so think of it this way. It's 1964, and somebody comes to you and says, I have a great story. Lyndon Johnson is running a child trafficking ring out of a pizza parlor here in D.C. How would you get that out? Well, in 1964, the only way you could have gotten out mass would have been to go to the New York Times or CBS. They would show
They'd never run it.
Right. You could self-publish. You, after all, do have free speech, and 10 people would see it.
Right.
There were some extremist outlets. You could go to the John Birch Society. You could go to the Communist Party.
They might have more people would see it, but not that many.
Only the people who went looking for that.
Right, exactly.
So the technology actually protected democracy from the worst kinds of misinformation and disinformation.
That was the limits of the technology. The nature of it,
So all our ideas about free speech were built without even awareness of that implicit technological limitation, which was what was actually making this feasible.
And then we had television, but we had the Fairness Doctrine, right?
And even then, there were only three networks.
There were only three networks.
And they actually ran their news programming with the same kind of curatorial responsibility.
Exactly.
As
they
the
didn't even
papers.
Think of their news programming as a profit center.
Right.
They thought of it as a public service.
Right. Although even after, and even today, I think that, you know, they don't look at those necessarily as profit maximization centers. They're willing to run them still largely that way.
Yeah, right. Okay. But you can't put technology in a bottle and lock it up, right?
Right.
So the social media and the internet, the democratization of information, both the distribution and access to it, is here. Feature of the future forever.
Right. So it has massively changed both the costs and the benefits side of the implicit balancing, which means we need to rethink this.
It seems like interventions could fall on one of two sides or both, on the side of the consumer, more digital literacy, and or on the side of the producer and distributor. So think of Twitter and Facebook and all these venues that are now in a way just as powerful as the New York Times, Washington Post, and so on, and the TV stations. And I think part of the problem is that we have at least half of our political entities not sufficiently committed to responsibility to the facts. In fact, arguably engaged in a campaign to weaken the grip of facts on the average voter. So in this condition, I don't know that we can rely on government to fund education to a sufficient level that we could actually make any real difference in the level of people's media literacy, digital literacy. We're going to have to rely on entities like Facebook and Twitter to be doing some
self-regulation. Oh, my God. So that's the new Facebook and Twitter. I've got nothing. Well, I've got a few things against them, but I think they're great things. I love this democratization. But I do think they have to. They can't be the main organ of civil society. That would be insane.
No.
But they do have to become like media companies, and they curate their content.
Right. But so the way you want to think about them, I think, is they are the 21st century newsstand. Right. So the guy on the corner at 7th Avenue and 42nd Street had a newsstand and he chose what it was that he would make available to his customers. And yes, he was limited by the physical technology to everything in the world, but that was not the basis of all his choices. He would say, I don't want to sell pornography, or I don't want to sell the John Birch paper. And the question is whether Facebook, Google, Twitter, shouldn't they exercise exactly that same kind of responsible judgment about what they're feeding their customers, because it has consequences?
Right. See, I think of that as a kind of civic virtue on the part of the newsstand holder. So the newsstand holder is not just a pure market, disinterested market force, right? The owner, he has to bring to bear some civic virtue, some commitment to our common good. I do not think that he can be forced or compelled to have that commitment. But, I mean, Mill talks about the not using the power of the prevailing opinion or the power of government to coerce things. But there's something beyond just indifference and compulsion. There's cultivation. I mean, I think we as a collectivity need to cultivate in one another.
Yeah, but I'm not sure you can do this without at least a threat of government regulation, in the same way that we got the movie industry and the alcohol industry to regulate themselves by the threat of regulation. If there's not something there in a world in which they still view themselves as corporations responsible to maximize the returns to their shareholders, that's the driving force. And we would need some way, something, to substitute that sense if we have an additional or different responsibility that has to shape the way we approach our business. You're not going to do that through persuasion. You're going to have to change the law somewhere. It might be antitrust.
I get you. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. It's the examined year, 2017. We're talking about the year in democracy and social media with Larry Kramer, president of the Hewlett Foundation. Look, if we view ourselves as just in what I call the Hobbesian jungle of free and unfettered, unconstrained competition, then like anything goes. Okay, we don't live in the Hobbesian jungle. So we want some regulation, right? We want to give the Leviathan some power. But we don't want the Leviathan to be stifling.
Right.
So we got to have some balance between that.
Right.
But where regulation ends, I still think there must be civic virtue, uncoerced civic virtue that we attempt to cultivate in one another through education.
To be honest, I think you can. I wouldn't even see sort of government regulation on the one hand and civic private virtue on the other as distinct that way. One of the things you can do, should do with law, is create the incentives, is cultivate that kind of sensibility. And appropriate sort of thinking about the role of government intersecting with private industry does exactly that.
Right.
I don't think the people in Facebook, the people who work there, they are genuinely distressed about what's going on. So we need to give them the room.
Okay, so
how do
we do this? How do we make the combination of law and private interests and all that give rise to more civic virtue, so that there will be more kind of spontaneous desire to curate so that the citizen will won't want to be like subject to the snake oil salesman, and we'll have that little thing, help me not be subject to the snake oil salesman.
Yeah.
Media.
Well, you know, the question, as I said, we've spent 50 years digging ourselves into this hole along so many dimensions.
I agree.
So civic education from the beginning is an important part of cultivating that. The whole kind of neoliberal framework, which sets competition as the thing that, you know, society is about protecting and fostering as opposed to collaboration and cooperation, is a huge contributor here. Turning that into the notion that if I run a business, I'm nothing but an agent to maximize this group's profits with no respect. You know, we need to change all of those things. So some of it is slow norm changing. Some of it is law changing. I think there are opportunities to begin to move this through antitrust laws, through accomplice laws. Tim Wu wrote a really interesting article with that.
So you're thinking of holding Facebook responsible as an accessory to certain kinds of crimes? Is that what you're talking about?
Making them potentially liable so that they then have the incentive not to do it. You could imagine micro liability so that any individual repost imposes such a small, nobody's going to be, but that as it goes viral, you'd have to worry about it, which would then say,
would
well, I'm going to have to make some choices.
Right. Yeah. I wonder sometimes about labeling. I mean, so Twitter currently has a feature that they sort of certify certain Twitter accounts as being authentically from a given individual. Couldn't they also label certain stories as being, you know, as deriving from, I don't know, more or less reliable sources, for example? I mean, it seems like there are certain fairly low-level...
doing that in real time is really difficult.
It would be tricky, but you could have it such that when something's first posted, it's not immediately verified unless it comes from a particular kind of source.
I mean, you know, one of my favorite false 20th century tropes around this was this notion that, you know, the cure for bad speech is more speech. But we always knew that actually once
not
it's out there, it
that's
never catches up.
That goes back to Mill,
doesn't it? It didn't matter when so little bad speech actually got out there, and now we have a problem.
Right.
I do also, I think it's in fairness, there are more companies and more entities involved in here than just the big ones. So in calling out, I think Twitter actually deserves a lot of credit for being much more open than most companies about sharing its data and making efforts. And Apple as well. Apple News actually does curate.
Right.
They're the one. They've said, you know, we don't need Apple News to be a profit center, so don't lose too much money. But let's just, you know, and more of that.
Yeah.
But there is that deeper core thing, which is, you know, education used to be about cultivating democratic citizenship not just career preparation. I mean, it's so many.
Right. I totally agree.
I
want to ask you one last question, one big question. And I just want to know your thoughts. I know it sounds like you're an admirer of our founding fathers. I think our Constitution was fine as an 18th century first try at this thing, but we've got a long, long experience in democratic self-governance.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think our Constitution needs to be rewritten root and branch, and we need to become a parliamentary democracy.
I don't know about becoming a parliamentary system. They're showing the same problems that we've had. What I would say is this. Fortunately, the founders of this country were not originalists. So they wrote that thing. They discovered in the 1790s right away that almost everything they thought was wrong, and they started adapting and adjusting. And we've been doing that ever since, better than tolerably well until very recently. So what I would say is the beauty of the Constitution, and it had some deep flaws. I mean, we had a civil war for a reason. Right. And we made a pretty radical set of revisions after, and then still took another century to give those life. But it has been in that struggle. And the interesting thing about the American constitutional process is that it has always been open for being as good or as bad as the American people were willing to let it be.
So let me ask you, look, 2017 has been a year of great turmoil in this domain of democracy and social media. What do you think is the single most important thing that our society can do in 2018?
I don't know that there is, to be honest, one thing. I think we have dug ourselves into such a deep hole along so many dimensions. I think we need to rethink the practice of politics. We need to replace political parties with at least something that did what they did. We need to replace this whole free market orthodoxy neoliberal framework with a set of ideas that restores room for constructive disagreement. We need to, you know, we need to fix this speech problem. We need to do all of those things, and we need to start doing them now.
So it sounds pretty simple.
Yeah. So anyway, this has been a great conversation.
Thank you so much for joining us. Super fun for me.
Larry Kramer, president of the Hewlett Foundation on the Year in Democracy and Social Media. This is Philosophy Talk. It's our annual philosophical year in review, the examined year 2017.
In our next segment, Josh and I will be joined by our host emeritus, John Perry, to help us think deep thoughts about the year that was.
It's our all-host roundtable panel when Philosophy Talk continues. Welcome back. It's the examined year 2017. I'm Josh Landy. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're taking a philosophical look at the past 12 months.
We're joined now by our host emeritus, John Perry. John's had plenty of time to think about the year that was, having retired from the show back in the spring. Maybe he can help us out of the doldrums we currently find ourselves in. John, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Well, it's great to be back. I mean, sleeping late and not thinking, those get old.
So you know what we're doing in this final segment? The three of us are going to talk about our own views about the most philosophically significant events or ideas or whatever of 2017. So we're going to start with you, because what do you think? What's really gotten on your mind about the past year from a kind of reflective point of view?
Well, I grew up in a Republican family. My father was a Republican. My first memory of anything political was the Dewey-Truman election, and my folks had thrown a party to celebrate, as they put it, the end of 20 years of Democrat misrule. And, you know, a shrink later told me it was the intense emotion and probably my learning that my father was not omnipotent that stayed with me for the rest of my life. But, you know, that the Republican Party was something to be kind of proud of then. I mean, as I was growing up, you had Eisenhower and, you know, you had Nixon, who didn't seem like a crook back then. And it's just so sad, if you have those kinds of memories, to see what's happened to it. I mean,
do you think, one of the things that the old Republican Party of Eisenhower and of the non-evil parts of Nixon,
in those days, you had to be 21 to vote, so I couldn't vote in 1960. I was just almost 21, but I would have voted for Nixon because I thought Kennedy was a warmonger with all this missile gap stuff. And back in those days, you thought of the Republicans as a party of civil rights.
So look, I don't want to live in a one-party state. I can't think of any well-functioning one-party state. I mean, multi-party states are a good thing. I mean, they can be fractious, and I would love it if there was one party that was saying, I want to run the activist government conjecture about how to solve certain problems. And the other one said, look, no, I want to run the market's anti-statist solution. And they compete to actually solve real problems. They actually competed. And the market-based party said, okay, here's a market-based solution. Let's try it out. And if it didn't work, and they would both be kind of experimental parties, right?
And here's a statist solution. The states can serve as laboratories for some of
these. Yeah, and the statist party could say, no, here's a state-based solution.
I think you misjudged, Ken. I mean, look at what the Democrats have to offer now. It is so compelling. It is this image of, if you just give us more money, we'll figure out something good to do with it. So every single day, you get five or six emails from every campaign or good cause you've ever given money to. But you never really see a vision. I guess I'm being cynical.
I'm not sure I totally buy that. I mean, that was very much a story that was being put around in the last election, that the Democrats, and in particular Hillary Clinton, didn't have a vision. A lot of that was just due to reporting. I mean, she had very specific policy proposals in her platform.
Well, that's true. But
what did the press talk about? They talked about her emails. And then the other aspect of this is sort of the cult of the new. I think a lot of Clinton's platforms were essentially some fairly tried and true Democratic positions, and people seem to be objecting simply to the fact that they weren't new. But what's the value of novelty in this context?
Well, but I think there's a deeper alienation that goes to the deep rot in American politics on all sides. I mean, I think the Bernie Sanders supporters and the Donald Trump supporters, there's a place where they meet, right? And the place where they meet is that these distant moneyed elites are out for themselves. They're gaming the system. They kind of want the corporations and the moneyed class to like make all the decisions, and they don't care really about us, and we're being ground down by globalization, and we're being this and that and inundated by foreigners, and we got to put a stop to this. So they don't trust anybody.
I think we ought to have a constitutional amendment, and my first draft would say, be it hereby resolved that corporations are not people, and in addition, no one who is an elected official of the federal government in any branch or in the judicial branch can accept any money other than their salary from anybody for anything, not even one cup of coffee.
I think you've put your finger on an important element of this issue, because, you know, obviously we're focusing on 2017, but some of the roots of what's going on now go a little bit further back, and certainly Citizens United made an enormous difference to the way in which things have unfolded, right? So you know, demise of the Fairness Doctrine, Citizens United, a kind of generalized assault on epistemic standards by certain members of the political classes and punditry classes. Everything seems to be this, you know, this dangerous, heady brew that got us into the place where we are now.
Yeah, I think the place where we are now, I don't know if you guys are going to agree with this. I'm going to say something extreme. I think we've been witnessing over many years, many, many years, for some of the reasons we've been talking about, the gradual rotting out of the American Republic. You know, in France, they're on their Fifth Republic. I think it's time for a new American Republic. I think we need to rewrite our Constitution. I think we need to redesign our civil society, because I don't think, and I think, I don't want to name names, but I think the current president signals the end of the American Republic. I really do.
But who's the General de Gaulle that's going to come along and give us a new way of doing things that isn't totally bonkers?
The only thing that gave me the slightest shred of hope of the past year has been signs of a kind of resistance. So kneeling at NFL games, the Me Too movement, the courage of various women across the country who stood up to denounce Harvey Weinstein and Roy Moore.
And the Women's March on Washington.
The Women's March on Washington. Right. Some of these gains in special elections, including by a transgender woman, Danica Rome, in Virginia. So there are some signs. But in general, one has to say, I agree with you, Ken, we're living in a very dangerous moment where there's all this money in politics. I mean, you had members of Congress explicitly saying, if we don't pass this law, our donors aren't going to be happy, as though the people they're responsible to are not the voters, they're their donors. It's the donors who make or break them. They're going to be passing laws that have an 80% unpopularity rating. They're going to be failing to pass laws on guns that everyone, you know, common sense laws. Yeah. So
85% of gun owners approve of.
85% of gun owners, a very common sense thing.
Oh, right.
So here, and then when there seems to be some threat to this, as in some kind of investigation, for example, of the top executive, then we're in this very dangerous moment where the response has been this kind of scorched earth response, attacking FBI, attacking the DOJ, attacking the free press. Attacking the independent judiciary. This is a really dangerous moment for our democracy.
Extremely. I think it's a 1933-like moment for America, when everything that we think we believe is about our republic and the functioning of our republic is deeply under threat of not being true. John, what do you think about that?
No, I more or less feel the same way. I hope in retrospect it will look over dramatic, but it certainly feels that way at points. I'm really worried now that Trump's gamble on this tax stuff may turn out right, that the people won't really feel the fact that we're going head over heels into debt, mostly because of military spending, not because of social spending and the tax cuts to billionaires. But maybe the short-term feelings will be so good that the 2018 elections won't be so bad. But you know, we've been through bad periods before. However, we haven't always done that well.
So let me ask you, I want you guys to engage in an act of America. I don't mean to frighten our listeners, but I want to, because here's the thing I think one learned, and this is a plea for vigilance, because I think, what do we need going forward? I think we need vigilance and intense vigilance, because I want you to engage in an exercise, and I'm going to connect it. Again, I don't mean to compare Trump to Hitler, but I want to compare it to the situation. So there were lots of Jews who voted for Hitler, knowing he was an anti-Semite, but they thought, well, we've been dealing with anti-Semites forever, and maybe this one can remake Germany. Maybe he's just an ordinary anti-Semite, but he's a pro-German anti-Semite, and Germany needs rebuilding, because Germany did need rebuilding, right? And then it turns out he was worse than an ordinary. He far exceeded the worst that they could imagine. Now, here's what I think people need to do. I don't know that the worst is true of the current moment, but imagine that worst that the current moment could be. that actually Trump is a Soviet tool, that he colluded with, he conspired with him, he committed treason, he's doing Vladimir Putin's business. He refused to staff the State Department because his master said, yeah, you don't need such a robust State Department, right? He's cooperating in Syria because his master said to him, I mean, that's the worst imaginable, right? The worst imaginable is that some of the Republicans know this, and just, right? Imagine the worst that it could be. And what would you do? Now, if that was the worst that you could be, how vigilant would you be? How full of resistance would you be? I don't think we have enough imagination about the worst possible because we want to believe the most comforting thing. But here's, I think, is a moment where what we need to do is let our imaginations run wild. That sounds like a downer thing, but that's to prepare you to resist the worst that it could be.
Ken, I think it's worse than your worst case scenario. Because you're making it seem as though it's just a case of the current president.
Yeah.
But in fact, it goes far deeper or broader than him. I mean, you think about the obstruction of the Merrick Garland appointment. You think about gerrymandering. You think about voter suppression.
Right.
Worst case scenario.
That's true.
That's part of my objection to the Democrats. Why aren't they coming out with a well-formulated constitutional amendment or a set of legislation against gerrymandering? They're just saying it's a bad thing because Republicans did it. But the Democrats have done it, too.
Oh, I agree with that.
And I do think that Charlottesville was a bright spot. I don't mean the Nazis marching on Charlottesville or the president's reaction, but the people's reaction to the president's reaction. So it didn't feel so 1933-ish at that point.
Oh, I agree. And I don't want to be alarmist. I'm just thinking here's an exercise. Well, but here's an exercise that I think...
You just want to get 350 million people marching on Washington, but you don't want to be an alarm.
I want to call people to like urgent vigilance.
I mean, the thought is not that there's about to be a genocide in this country.
Right.
The thought is more there's about to be a demise of our democratic ideals.
Right.
Right. That people's voices simply won't be heard anymore.
And that's why we need a new republic. And we could do a whole show on what this new republic might look like. Maybe philosophers could be king as a Plato.
I think John should.
Yeah,
be
John,
king.
You want to be our philosopher king in our new American republic and our second or third or.
Once I finish the two books I'm working.
Okay. So on that note, I guess we can wrap this up, huh?
John, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
An all-host panel featuring our host emeritus, John Perry, on the current state of our democracy. You want to hear more of John's wit and wisdom? Tune in next week for a special program. We made John the guest to share his wisdom on the philosophy of retirement.
We invite you to continue examining the year that was, 2017, at our online community of thinkers, the Philosopher's Corner, where our motto is, Cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. Now, what did 2017 mean to a guy who fast-talked his way through it? Let's hear from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, interesting year 2017. The top-grossing movie of the year pre-Star Wars was the live-action Disney movie Beauty and the Beast, which took in $1.3 billion worldwide, beating out the boring cartoon version. And, of course, the Jean Cocteau masterpiece, which has only made a dollar since its first release in 1946. True. A tune called Despacito became the most watched video of all time, garnering 4.1 billion views on YouTube. The Earth, by the way, only holds 7.4 billion people. Think about that. Rachel Dolezal, the white woman who identified as black, to great ridicule and somewhat dull chat show discussions, has released a 2018 calendar featuring tasteful photos of her, inspirational quotes, and black history facts scattered throughout the year. Yay, I guess. Chuck Berry died, and so far, despite his sexual peccadilloes, his reputation remains untarnished, unlike Garrison Keillor, who did not die, but touched a woman's back or something and is having his name stripped from public radio, the way Soviet functionaries were airbrushed out of pictures with Stalin. In September, the fans of the rap duo Insane Clown Posse called Juggalos gathered at the Lincoln Memorial to protest their designation as a gang by the FBI. It did not work. In May, a Google computer program beat the world's best Go player. Let alarmed op-eds about robot takeovers resume, until those too become computer-written. The world moved closer to robot-driven cars. Car makers, tech folks, journalists, and politicians eager to meet new lobbyists are excited about robot cars. America, not so much. Maybe in 2018, when it's too late. Anthony Weiner was caught sexting again with a female, not his wife, and underage, off to prison for 21 months, young man. Thank Harvey, Irma, Jose, and Katia for the bad weather. Thank California for the fires. An iceberg the size of Delaware broke off Antarctica. Politician John Conyers resigned because America saw his penis. A Democrat won in Alabama. Hell froze over for a millisecond and an elephant flew. Was Johnny Halliday the Elvis of France or was Elvis the Johnny Halliday of America? Let the op-eds begin. A very brief conspiracy theory posited that Melania Trump deployed a body double at a press conference in October. That made no sense at all, but whatever. There was big violence in Las Vegas. Bitcoin finally became another fluctuating collector's item like gold or Beanie Babies. Remember the solar eclipse? Me neither. Al Franken resigned. When is it okay to punch a Nazi? The year-long debate rages on with no end in sight. Also, a six-year-old made $11 million reviewing toys on YouTube. And yet we have homeless people sleeping on the street. Why not give them toys and a YouTube channel and free fentanyl for those who need it while we're at it? Speaking of which, how are you supposed to buy things with Bitcoin exactly? I can see having Bitcoin parking meters, assuming you can stave off robot cars for another year. Robot cars never park. They just circle the city like vultures or seagulls. Heavy finagling by Governor Scott Walker has Wisconsin offering $3 billion in subsidies to an outfit named Foxconn, which promises a factory three times bigger than the Pentagon to make components for big screen TVs. Foxconn has already backed out of similar sweetheart deals in Brazil, Indiana, and Pennsylvania, so keep your fingers crossed, Wisconsin. I predict you'll be better off broke. I was trying to keep the president out of this year in summary, but Omarosa Newman, former Apprentice star, left the White House in December. What she did there, I don't know. Communications? But she was supposed to stay till the end of January, I heard. Now she's left in a huff. Or maybe a Tesla or Uber. I don't know. We will get answers maybe from her ghostwritten memoir, which will hit the bookshelf summer 2018. And I'll find my copy of The Goodwill come Christmas time 2018. Again, assuming I have any money left after paying taxes and the phone company for the new improved internet. Thank you, America. Your blessings are many and cost a lot. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University. Copyright 2018.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Matt Martin.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Angela Johnston, and Colin Peden.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
This was the largest audience to ever witness an inauguration, period.